Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This is the day of the month that we have set aside to deal with personal finance issues. We've been doing this for a long time to give folks a chance to ask very specific questions about their financial planning strategies, and we'll be doing that here this morning as we welcome back to the program David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois, and for a long time has been doing the show with us on a regular basis. So we do this is he begins and has a few comments to make. Sometimes he talks about the economy generally and sometimes about some specific topic that has to do with financial planning. But then you, if you have questions about whatever it is he begins with or anything else that has to do with investing and money management, you give us a call. He'll do his best to help you out. And with that, we'll say welcome back. Glad to have you with us.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. First, I want to thank Kevin Wasby for pinch hitting for me in June. And he will also be with you next month on this program. Of course, Kevin is one of the outstanding faculty members in our Department of Finance at the University of Illinois. And then, David, I guess if you'll put up with me, I'll return for, I believe, our 19th fall season together. Thank goodness we're both getting younger. That's all I can say. All right, enough levity. After all, we are facing unprecedented economic issues, all in the midst of a presidential campaign. There are so many things we could visit about. For example, the bank failure of Indy Mac earlier this week. And people, can you imagine this, literally clamoring at the locked doors on Monday morning to withdraw their money. I guess these are scenes that I remember from our history books, reminiscent of the Great Depression and the bank runs of 1929. Well, we could visit about both the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, announcing, well, let's call them rescue plans, essentially loaning money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which really are our mortgage market, literally controlling trillions of dollars of mortgages. So these two quasi-government private entities can continue to provide liquidity in the mortgage market so Americans can continue to obtain conventional mortgages. Or perhaps we should talk about $4 gas everywhere, and $150 a barrel oil earlier this week, now about $130 a barrel oil. And most interesting, it seems to me, I've been watching a little bit of television, and I keep seeing this oil man, this T. Boone's Pickens fellow, a billionaire who refers to himself as an oil man, says it's time to solve the energy problems in America, and he's in the throes of announcing a national energy program on television, radio, and print, during the next 2 weeks. And interestingly enough, there are a lot of energy experts out there who are extremely interested in what he has to say. And of course, we could turn to Al Gore calling for, well, really electrical, I guess, electricity independence within 10 years. There's a lot of things out there we could talk about. What about a predicted 2.5 million home foreclosures this year? Continued falling home prices in most areas of the country. And rising unemployment, especially in the manufacturing, construction, automobile, and financial industries. That continues with the announcements, for example, from GM earlier this week, sizing down by 20% of all white-collar jobs. And huge price increases reflected in everything we buy as a result of accelerating inflation, the price of basic commodities, and the shrinking American dollar. We could visit about that. It was announced just yesterday that consumer price indexes that were up, what, 1.1% from the previous month. That's a huge, huge increase. If you look at the CPI year to date, if you believe the Government of Labor statistics, greater than a 5% increase across the board. Of course, we know that food and energy are significantly higher. And finally, all of this economic reality is reflected in a brutal stock market, where most major indices and individual stocks are hovering in that bear market territory, having lost approximately 20%, a little bit of a recovery the last 2 days. Putting it another way, more than $3.5 trillion of shareholder worth has disappeared in the last 12 months. That can't make investors very happy, losing $3.5 trillion, and in addition, watching their home equity dissipate. It's certainly no wonder that Americans, based on polling, are more concerned about the American economy than ever since polling began. Now, against this backdrop, I want to focus on two areas. First, each month, we examine together the results of our couch potato portfolio. And secondly, let's spend a few moments on how all of these economic factors are going to impact our retirement or retirement planning. First, with respect to the couch potato portfolio, at least through last night's close, this all-equity portfolio, consisting of 8 index funds, is down about 12% for the year, as compared to our benchmark S&P 500 index, which is down a little bit over 13%. Now, both these portfolios are inclusive of dividends. That's year-to-date. We're down 12 in our portfolio. Our benchmark, our proxy, is down about 13. So we're running a little bit ahead. Diversification still seems to be holding up to the extent we can call it a 1% differential. Now, if you want to follow that couch potato portfolio in particularity, of course, go to the WILL website, click on AM 580, click on links, and then click on the David Sinnoh Couch Potato Portfolio, and it is updated through last night's close. Now, while these numbers are unsettling, to say the least, I strongly urge everyone, of course, not to panic and consider the lessons of history. Since 1945, for example, according to Sam Stovall, S&P's chief equity strategist, bear markets, and no question we're in bear markets, they last an average of 14 months, and they generally take about an additional 12 months from their bottoms to regain the lost ground. Isn't that interesting? About a 26-month period of time. And since World War II through 2007, the S&P 500 index has risen by an annual average of 9.1%. And if we consider dividends on all of the stocks in the S&P 500, we're still talking approximately an annual average of about 13%. So finally, despite the state of a very ugly stock market today, as long as you behave and think like a legacy investor, I continue to counsel you to think in that manner. In other words, you're investing for at least a 30-year time horizon or more in diversified stock markets. It's still one of the best places that you can place your funds. But again, the minute you start thinking short-term, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I counsel you that it's not a great place to be, because when stocks move up, you've got to be in the market because they move up very, very quickly. There might be only a 3 or 6 month window where stocks might even recover all of their losses. And if you're sitting on the sidelines and then waiting to get in, you're doomed. You're going to have a negative investment experience. So please don't panic. Stay the course. And remember, you're not putting all of your money in equities. Most of you entering retirement or moving toward retirement might well indeed have a 60-40 asset allocation. We've talked about that in the past, about 40% of your funds in equities and 60% of your funds in short-term fixed income instruments, whether they are denominated in certificates of deposit, treasury instruments, and or money markets. All right. So this leads us really into the second segment of my introductory remarks, is how to prepare for retirement when your stock market portfolio is hemorrhaging. In other words, how to bulletproof your retirement nest egg. Now, if you are contemplating retirement, here are some suggestions. Number one, get rid of debt, especially credit card and other forms of consumer debt. It's very, very difficult to retire if you are facing monthly mortgage and interest-bearing credit card payments, especially in an increasing inflationary environment where interest rates inevitably are going to trend up. Two, realistically appraise your retirement expenses, especially your medical expenses, including dental. Almost all retired Americans have vastly underestimated these costs, especially when one considers Medicare premiums, deductibles, copays, over-the-counter meds, and dental procedures. Indeed, just yesterday, I had a client of mine send me some information on some medical expenses that she recently incurred for some very, very serious surgery and follow-up chemotherapy and other types of care. The numbers were literally staggering. Fortunately, she was covered for the most part by insurance. Those dollars were over $200,000 of coverage. It's just almost unbelievable. And new meds, which weren't covered by either Medicare or other programs, were going to cost in the neighborhood of $300 to $500 a month, certainly for at least the next 60 months. So again, when you talk to people who are retired or are retiring, one of their biggest concerns and one of the things that they really have underestimated is the cost of medical care. And indeed, even Medicare premiums for those of us who have Medicare are going to be going up, and they're going to be really, they are now almost being indexed for the kinds of income that you have. Three, be sure to conduct an energy audit. Does the size of your home make sense? Or does sizing down make sense, especially in light of escalating energy costs? Is your automobile reasonably fuel efficient? And do you have access to decent public transportation? So I think these things are going to become far more important: energy at the home and access to public transportation. And we see that already as a result of $4 gas, that consumption has dropped about 3 or 4% over the last month as Americans are carpooling, they're driving less, they're adopting alternative forms of transportation. Now, take a careful look at your sources of retirement income other than your retirement portfolio. For example, are you blessed with a retirement annuity from your place of employment? And if so, is it indexed in some way for inflation? What is your estimated Social Security payments, and what are the ramifications of retiring early and beginning those payments early? Finally, and here's the key, most importantly, do you have at least 3 years of cash reserves on hand at all times to cover 3 years of annual expenses beyond the income you receive from retirement sources? So let me give you an example. You're planning to retire, and you conclude that your annual expenses, including income taxes, state taxes, everything, approximates $50,000 per year. You find out that Social Security and a retirement annuity will cover half of that expense, or about $25,000 a year. Now, the remaining $25,000 has to be accessed from your various savings programs. Maybe they're IRAs, maybe they're 401ks, maybe they're after-tax CDs, money markets, etc. Here's the key. At all times, regardless of your overall asset allocation, all of us need to have, as we approach retirement or are in retirement, at least 3 years of money set aside for the expenses that we are going to have in addition to our other investments. So if annuities cover half of our $50,000 need, that means $25,000 is not covered and it's got to come out of our investment portfolio. We multiply that $25,000 times 3, that's $75,000. And that at all times during retirement, that amount of money should be in short-term securities, short-term money market funds, etc., so you have access to those. Because if you set yourself up in that manner, you will be able to weather difficult bear markets, difficult stock market periods like the one we're in now, as you will not be forced to sell your stocks at fire sale prices and thereby possibly struggle financially for years to come. This, of course, takes discipline. It takes planning, and hopefully motivates you to consult with your planner, with your financial advisor, to set this kind of program up as you get closer or if you are indeed already in retirement. So there you have it, David. I've covered a waterfall, I guess, a watershed of issues. Some of them are actually falling, and I'd be happy to discuss permutations of these issues or anything else on our listeners' minds.
All right. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about investing and money management, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, when I was sitting here, I was making notes as you were listing all of the reasons for concern, and I kept thinking to myself, okay, now at some point he's going to start giving us some good news. there doesn't seem to be any. Is there anything there that you can grab onto for just at least a little bit of hope that at some point things are going to start to to turn around.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of good news. The good news is that we are the most resilient economy in the world. And we are an entrepreneurial economy. We still come up with more new ideas, more patents, more copyrights, new ways of solving old problems than anyone else in the world. And that is good news. We have an economy that is in the multi-trillions, somewhere between $13 and $15 trillion GDP, depending upon who you believe. And that is good news. We are still the largest economic engine in the world. So there's a lot to be thankful for. There's a lot of people with good jobs. But overall, when you poll Americans, they are very concerned about the direction that the economy is going and the direction the country is going, and with good measure, and with good measure. So.
One other thing, and we got some callers we'll get to right in a moment. Just I happened to be talking the other day with a colleague about this issue of the concern over the health of banks. And as you said, we saw this this failure of a bank, the IndyMac Bank. And there are some, as I read stories about this, there apparently are some concerns that there might be some other banks that would be in danger of failing. And some very large banking chains have announced very dramatic declines in the value of their stock. The place where I bank happens to be one of them. So the question that this my colleague had was, well, how do you evaluate? Is there any way to evaluate the health of your bank so that you can either maybe be concerned or then, on the other hand, say, okay, I don't really need to worry. I don't think that my bank is going to fail.
I don't think most banks are going to fail. And let's put this into perspective. There have been six bank failures this year. That's not unusual in terms of the number of banks. Now, the size of the bank, IndyBank, which was a $25 billion bank located in California, Pasadena, one of its headquarters. That's where most of the pictures came out of. That was an unusual situation because they were in the business of making high-risk mortgages. And they didn't sell off all of those mortgages. They kept a lot of them on their shelves. So as a result, as those mortgages started to hemorrhage and go down in value, they were eating up their own capital of their financial institution. They were getting in a negative equity position. And as a result, the feds, the FDIC, came in and took over that institution. Most banks are not in that situation. IndyMac was playing a very dangerous game, having so much of this paper sitting on their shelves and really, really very high-risk paper. Historically, banks have been required to have a lot of equity capital, all right? So for every dollar of assets that pour into a bank typically has somewhere between 6 and 9% of their own bank capital, that's shareholder capital, to shore up any issues with a financial institution. So the good news is that most banks are highly capitalized and can weather storm. Sure, no one likes to see these negative losses, and there are going to be more losses that are going to be announced. But the good old-fashioned bank, not the investment banks, but the good old-fashioned banks that you and I bank at, for the most part, are well capitalized. Now, a word of caution. If you have more than $100,000 in a financial institution, step across the street and take some of that money and get it FDIC insured. Okay? There's no reason to be lazy about it. Certainly, prudence would dictate to have more than $100,000 in your name in a financial institution isn't terribly sensible. And I'm not casting any aspersions on any of our local institutions, which are very, very solid and very, very strong. But still, prudence would suggest that it makes some sense to diversify, and you can diversify among financial institutions, and you might as well have your money insured.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk with some folks here who are listening. We'll start here with White Heath. The first caller is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was just curious, because of the situation of our economy, that what would be some of the positives and negatives of interest rates starting to go up a little bit?
Well, the positives of interest rates moving up, it makes our dollar more attractive. That's one thing. And it would probably shore up the relationship between the dollar and some international currencies. That's probably the most positive thing that would take place as a result of an increase in interest rates. And it may also slow down inflationary pressures.
What about gasoline prices?
Raising interest rates, what impact would that have on gasoline prices?
Uh-huh. Would it have
if the American dollar would firm up against other international currencies, then it would probably reduce the price of a barrel of oil, which theoretically would then translate in reducing gasoline prices.
Uh-huh.
Now, the difficulty is that we are in a very, very slow growth, if at all, or recessionary mode in our economy.
Uh-huh.
And typically, one of the ways to jumpstart an economy is to reduce interest rates, making things cheaper for you and I to borrow money and buy goods, whether it's an automobile, whether it's consumer staples, whatever, or spending more money because interest rates are reasonable, and as a result, we feel fairly comfortable about going out and spending money. The problem is that we have pretty darn low interest rates already.
Uh-huh.
We have a commercial prime rate of 5%, a federal funds rate, that's the rate at which banks borrow overnight from each other, of 2%. So we already have relatively low interest rates, and it's very, very difficult for the Federal Reserve to reduce interest rates further without triggering additional inflation. So we're caught kind of in a catch-22 situation. If we were had higher interest rates, yes, maybe we could lower interest rates and spur the economy, but we're really not in that situation at the current time.
Well, I'm suggesting we raise interest rates. but I don't know. It just seems like that these low interest rates have gotten us into a lot of trouble. So anyway.
Well, there's no question that ultimately, interest rates are going to move up. They just have to. They have to make the dollar more stable and to deal with these vast inflationary pressures.
Uh-huh.
So it's coming. It's just a matter of when. So for people who are sitting on the sidelines with lots of cash, they should continue to sit on the sidelines and not invest in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7-year maturity paper, because pretty soon there is going to be this upward increase in interest rates. And as a result, by waiting, you're going to get higher interest rates on your money.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Uh-huh. Next caller is in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Yes. I'd like you to discuss the living trust and what that does for older senior people, and if it's a good thing to be involved in and so forth and so on. Just explain what it is and then tell us if it's good for people who are 60 plus.
Okay, we can spend a little time talking about a living trust. First of all, let's talk about a trust. A trust is a legal instrument. It has someone who wants to be the maker of the trust, the author of the trust. That's called the grantor. That's the individual who wants this trust. A trust also has a trustee. That's an individual who is charged with the responsibility of carrying out the wishes of the grantor or the maker of this trust, and of course that's delineated in writing. A trust also has someone who benefits one or more individuals. That's called a beneficiary. There may be more than one. For example, there may be a parent, there may be a child, there may be someone else who is a beneficiary. And finally, there has to be something that you administer as part of this trust, and that is called the corpus of the trust. So that administrative part of the trust might be stocks, it might be mutual funds, it might be real estate, it might be a combination of a number of things. It's called a living trust because this trust is actually written, drafted, and signed while you are living. As a matter of fact, I have one. It's called the David Sinnow Living Trust, UAD, which stands for Under Agreement Dated. And let's say July 1, 2008. That would be the name of your trust. And then what you do is you place certain assets into the trust. And how do you do that? By simply retitling an asset. Maybe it just says David Sinnow currently. So you send a letter to your local bank and say, I want to have this retitled. Here's the first page of my trust. Here's the signature page of my trust. And I want you to retitle it as the David Sinnow Revocable Living Trust Under Agreement dated January 1, 2008. Now, you ask a different question. What are the advantages or disadvantages, or does this make sense? Now, if you have an estate in excess of $2 million, then from an estate tax standpoint, it can make very, very good sense. So if your estate is under $2 million, then from an estate tax standpoint, at least under current law, it really doesn't matter whether you simply had the assets titled in your own name or whether you had them in a trust. But if you are married or if you have a substantial estate, then there are some estate tax advantages to trusts. Number two, a trust, unlike a will, is a private document. So many people have a very simple will, which is a public document. It gets filed in the courthouse, in the probate division of the courthouse. It says, I, David Sinnoh, being of sound mind and memory, leave everything in the whole wide world according to my trust. Sincerely yours, David Sinnoh. That's basically my will. That doesn't tell anyone anything about my personal affairs, because my personal affairs are all embodied and tied up in my trust, which is a private document. So, from a privacy standpoint, trusts make good sense. Finally, trust assets generally are not subject to probate and the probate process. So as a result, if the assets have already been titled in the name of the trust, then those assets do not go through the probate process, and the probate process can be expensive, it can be burdensome, depending upon how an estate is set up. So bottom line is that it may or may not have estate tax consequences, and it may have value, depending upon the size of your estate. A trust is a private document, and finally, your trust assets would not go through the probate process. It would avoid the probate process. So as a result, there are some advantages of having a trust. For the typical person, however, who doesn't have a lot of assets, maybe just a home, maybe some bank accounts, it may not be necessary. There are many, many competent estate planning lawyers all throughout Champaign County, as well as the state of Illinois, who specialize in this kind of document. It's not terribly expensive, and they can explain to you all of the ins and outs. I've just sort of given you a basic overview of what a living trust is. Also, most living trusts are revocable living trusts, which means that you can change them, alter them, amend them, even tear them up so long as you are living. They only become irrevocable, not revocable, at death. So, when you have a living trust, do you need a new tax identification number? No. You use your own Social Security number. So, for example, if you had a revocable living trust and you had a $100,000 asset in that revocable living trust, maybe it's a CD, and it throws off $4,000 of interest income, you would report that on your personal tax return under your own Social Security number. So it's a very, very easy document to execute, but it does have a lot of profound consequences, and you need to understand them before you simply go ahead and set up a revocable living trust.
All right. Hope that helps. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. David Sinnoh is with us. He's a clinical professor of finance at the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And once a month on a Friday, he's here, and we do these shows to talk about money management. If you have questions on your own personal finance situation, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Shelbyville is the next caller, line four. Hello.
Yes. I have a question about my retirement and my position, that whether or not you think it would be a good idea based on my assets. My wife and I have approximately about $750,000, and either it will be, I'll have a pension, I guess a lump sum from my company and her company. We'll have no debt for cars or house or anything like that. Our real estate would be worth about $250,000. And what I'm interested in is I'm wondering if I'll be 62, whether I should take out, at this point, I should go the Social Security route. I want to still work part-time. And my expenses for what I've accumulated, I think that to keep our lifestyle the same as we're living at, will probably be around a net of about $3,600 a month. Based on these kind of figures, I was kind of curious of what you thought about whether or not it would be a good time for me to retire at 62, or should I wait a year or so based on the numbers I've given you.
Well, let me ask you some additional questions so I can give you a better answer and clarify a couple of things. You mentioned that you have some retirement assets of approximately $750,000. That's in addition to your pension assets. Is that correct?
No, the pension, well, I have pension for a teacher pension and Social Security. You know, the pension for a teacher will probably be about $1,000 a month.
Okay, so you'll have a teacher's pension of $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something about taking a lump sum.
Yeah, I have a lump sum with my company that will be approximately $600,000.
So that's a pension lump sum. Is that part of that retirement, that $750,000 retirement?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And do you have a opportunity, as opposed to taking a lump sum, do you have the opportunity to annuitize that? Have you looked at that possibility?
The company will let me have approximately $2,500 for an annuity for my wife and I, which she'll get 50% of for the rest of my life.
Okay. One of the things that you should do is you should talk to a planner mm-hmm. and do some mathematics to see, based upon your actuarial life expectancies, is that $2,500 adjusted for inflation?
No, it isn't.
Okay. To take a look at whether or not you might be better off or taking that lump sum and looking at another potential indexed annuity. One of my biggest concerns for people who are retiring at 62, 63, 64, whatever, is the impact of inflation over the next 20 or 25 years.
Right.
It's called longevity risk. And while $750,000 sounds like a lot of money, the truth of the matter is that investing that at 3, 4, 5% and then paying income tax on that, it's not going to keep up with inflation. So one of the things that I want you to look at is the possibility of taking some of that money and buying a indexed annuity with it. That may be a possibility, but you'd have to talk to a planner. The other thing is that if you're going to work part-time, remember that your normal retirement age is probably either 66 or 67.
Right.
So probably 67. So that
66, yeah.
Is it 66 for you? Okay. At 66, that you're going to be taking a pretty good hit of about 20% less than what you would have gotten if you had waited. And in addition, if you work part-time, you're going to come up under a limit where you would have to start giving your Social Security back.
That's so right. It's about 13.
About 13K, right. Yeah. So if you've got to make less than that. But the good news is that you have no debts, and the real issue is this longevity risk, and is this enough money to retire on? Are you tired of working?
No, I'm not really tired of working what I'm doing. I want to work in something that probably pays less than
okay.
But something I'm going to enjoy a little more.
Okay. Well, if you have a teacher's retirement annuity, and that is indexed for inflation of $1,000 a month, did you have an estimate on what you would receive from Social Security?
It would be about $1,400. So
okay.
I'd probably get about $30,000 that will be indexed.
Okay. So you have $30,000 of indexed and no debts. Then, and you're going to work part-time?
Right.
Okay. So I think if you have $30,000 of money that continues to get indexed, you keep a relatively, you know, it sounds like you have a low overhead standard of living. You've been careful.
Mm-hmm.
And you have your medical taken care of. Check
right.
on how you're going to have your medical taken care of.
The company that I'm with right now will give me medical benefits.
Until 65?
Until 65.
Okay. What about your spouse?
And it'll include my spouse, and it'll be dental and prescription and health and about $500 a month, which I've put into my net expenses. My net expenses I've put out, consuming that I'm going to have to replace a car and maintenance
mm-hmm.
of the house and things of that
mm-hmm.
nature.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't indexed that net expense with inflation, which bothers me because I think we're in for some real nasty inflation.
Oh, we are.
In 10 years.
We probably are. So that on the basis of what you told me, I think if you have $30,000 of indexed money coming in and you maintain your current lifestyle and you have your medical covered, which
right.
is very, very important, and you put aside in your retirement portfolio at least 3 years of fixed income money so you don't have to hemorrhage your portfolio if you have to sell stock so you don't get yourself into that situation, I think you're in pretty good shape. You're in pretty good shape.
If I took the approximately $700,000 that it'll be in an IRA and put approximately 40% of that into equities or stock, mm-hmm. and a portion of maybe a third of that into international stock,
mm-hmm.
a good proportion there to hedge against inflation.
I think so. And, I mean, you might look at our couch potato portfolio. I wouldn't put 40% in at one time. I'd dollar cost average that in certainly over 12 to 18 months.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Champagne. This is line 3. Hello. Caller there, Champ.
This is Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bloomington. I'm sorry. It's the change there on my screen. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I want to ask if speculation in oil futures by the oil-rich countries themselves could be partly responsible for increasing the price of oil. It seems to me that oil-rich countries buying oil futures contracts, they could bid up the price of oil, which they themselves are selling. If they bid up the price of oil futures contracts, they would probably be able to sell those futures contracts at a profit before they have to take delivery of the oil. And since they are selling the oil, they make a huge profit as they bid up the price of their own oil. Is that possible?
Well, it's possible. I haven't seen any historical or recent evidence that that's the case. Usually what happens is that someone who owns the commodity will hedge the opposite direction and will short the market as opposed to being long the market to lock in a fixed price. So is it possible? Perhaps. Is there any evidence that we've seen of that? Not that I'm aware of. I haven't read anything to that effect. And as I say, when you are in the agricultural business and you are actually the planter, the farmer, the person who has the corn in the field, usually you're going to take the opposite position to lock in that position.
Okay.
That's an interesting theory. And as I say, if you come across some information, some evidence of that, please by all means share it with us.
Well, it seems to me that occasionally, if you had an organized countries organizing a system of bidding up the price of oil, occasionally
mm-hmm.
they would have to take a loss on
mm-hmm.
a
sure.
contract.
Sure.
But that loss would be trivial compared to the profits they would make from the inflated price of their own oil.
Perhaps. I think the real issue when you're buying in the future, at least purchasing those through the normal exchanges in the United States, one of the difficulties and one of the problems is that you can buy a dollar's worth of oil for a nickel. You put up a nickel and you can control a dollar.
Uh-huh.
So you get 20 times your leverage. So that has the opportunity for enormous profits and for very, very small swings
mm-hmm.
in the price of oil. In contradistinction, of course, you can lose a lot of money as well. But in an upwardly trending market, when you can take a nickel and control a dollar of a product that's moving upward, wow, that's a good bet. And a lot of hedge funds obviously are being criticized and being accused of doing that very thing.
Well, thank you very much.
About 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. And once a month on a Friday, he's here and we talk about money management. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is Charleston, line 1. Hello.
Thank you very much. I have some, first of all, I have a defined benefit pension from CSRS, but also have some IRAs that I'm in a required minimum distribution phase right now. And I was thinking, this forces you into a situation, assuming you've built up the IRAs over a long period of time, of making the basic formula upside down. You know, you bought high and sold low. Is there any way, a recommendation you would make was something specific to do with the money if you don't need it right away, or to somehow to avoid that upside down or let's say the backwards to the recommendation sort of situation that you're in when you're having to take required minimum distributions now?
Well, one of the things that you can do that people don't realize is take the required minimum distribution as opposed to taking it in cash, take it in stock. or take it in shares of the mutual fund. In other words, have those shares that you're required to take and liquidate, have those shares transferred to a taxable account. So we could have the Davidson IRA, and let's pretend that I have 10,000 shares of IBM in my IRA, and it's worth X number of dollars, and I have to take some of that IBM as my minimum distribution. So typically what people do is they sell some IBM, and they then report that income on their tax return. Well, you have to report it, but let's report it in kind. So transfer the required number of mutual fund shares, transfer the required number of shares in a stock to a taxable account. And that way you've still held on to your position. Now, admittedly, you've got to pay income tax on it. So if you have to take a $10,000 minimum distribution, you haven't taken it in cash, you've taken it in stock, now you're still holding the stock. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. I've been doing something similar, but with an intermediate step of having the money put in a good money market fund, and then thinking about what to do with it from there. But you've suggested a way to just sort of take a shortcut right to some other equity investments.
Well, right. You keep your same equity investment. You keep your same equity investment. In other words, if you have to take a $10,000 minimum distribution of IBM stock, you take that $10,000 of IBM stock out of your IRA, and now you put it in your personal account. Now you've got $10,000 of IBM stock in your personal account. You're going to have a $10,000 ordinary income tax impact that you're going to have to report on your tax return. Your basis, however, now in that $10,000 of IBM stock is $10,000. Follow me? So now if you sell it for $10,000, well, you have no gain or loss, and maybe you replace that with other stock or other mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just hang on to it.
Yeah.
Got it?
Okay. I got it. Thank you very kindly. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Next, we will go to a caller on line number two. I believe this is someone in McLean County. Hello.
That's correct.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, good. I have two questions, and the first one is, I know you've talked a lot, and I cannot believe it. I just turned the radio on. I'm sorry, I really missed the rest of your program. But what I was wondering is, if I were to buy mutual funds, could you get me, or could you suggest maybe four or five major things to look at to decide whether I want one or not? Because I think, or which one to purchase, for example. Because it's still really quite complicated, but I'm trying to see if I can simplify without getting buried under it.
All right, let's take that question first of all. And what I would suggest that you do is you read about mutual funds. Mm-hmm. There is an excellent book called The S&P Guide to Money and Investing. It's about 150 pages. It costs about $12. And it's just an excellent, excellent book. And it covers in particularity mutual funds. All right, let's choose first whether or not you are interested in having a mutual fund that is very low expense and not involving a broker. That's called a no-load mutual fund. Or whether you want to work with a broker and buy a commission-based mutual fund. I, for one, when it comes to mutual funds, think that most people should be buying what are called no-load mutual funds. So when you invest $10 in a mutual fund, you've bought $10 worth of that mutual fund, not $9.50, and the other 50 cents ends up with a brokerage firm. Mm-hmm. So you have to choose whether or not you want to work with a broker in a commissionable fund or go direct to a mutual fund company and have what is referred to as a no-load fund.
I'm thinking about no-load fund.
Okay.
In terms of expenses, what's a reasonable percentage?
Well, if you follow my particular philosophy, which is to utilize index funds, those are mathematically based funds, and they have very low expense ratios because they don't have expensive money managers and lots of trading costs involved with a mutual fund. Mm-hmm. So if you can buy a mutual fund that has an internal expense ratio of somewhere between 0.2% up to about 0.6%, I think at least you're in the ballpark. Most index funds are between 0.2% and 0.4% for annual expenses on that mutual fund, which are very reasonable. The next question is, are you interested in a income mutual fund, a fixed income mutual fund, or are you interested in a stock mutual fund? So you've got to make that choice, or perhaps you're interested in a balanced mutual fund. That's a mutual fund that will hold both stocks and fixed income securities. So you have to make that choice.
Okay.
If you're looking just for a good old-fashioned vanilla stock mutual fund, perhaps you could look at something like the Vanguard Total Market Index, which is where you are actually buying the entire U.S. stock market at a very, very low cost, less than 0.2%. And you can buy that from a number of mutual fund companies. I happen to recommend Vanguard because it's just a mutual fund company that I follow and I utilize for some of my clients.
Okay. Now, you know, the turnover percentages in the stocks, you know, if you look down, you know, the portfolio, whatever it says, the turnover is 50%,
70%, 110%. The greater the turnover, the higher the transaction costs. Okay. So I'm not a great big believer in high turnover mutual funds. Because studies have been conducted that show over long, long periods of time, low turnover mutual funds actually return better returns to their investors than high turnover mutual funds.
Okay. So what's the range? Do you have a range that you say to keep it below? Like, is it best to keep it below 50?
Or? Way below 50. More like 20, 25.
Okay. All right. Any other big things? Because the other things I've been looking at so far is the expense.
Track record. What about track record?
Okay.
Track record of the fund. Take a look at the track record of the fund.
Okay. Now, what do I look at to figure that one out?
Well, you could look at Morningstar. You can go to www.morningstar.com. They have free software, and they will show you 1 year, 3 year, 5 year track records, 10 year track records. You can go to the mutual fund itself on the web, and you can look at their track records.
When you say track record, you mean the percent return?
Right, the rates of return, not over the last year, but over the last 3, 5, and 10 years at a minimum.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Is there anything else you can add to the things that I'm looking at so far?
No, I think if you do those things and do more reading, you'll be in good shape.
Okay. The next question is, this is a short one, is could you give me the, you know, you mentioned, I've listened to you before, you say your couch potato fund and things like that. You have a place where you, a website. Do you have a website where you have?
It's actually on the WILO website.
Okay, and then
if you just go to will.illinois.edu and then click on AM and then click on Focus 580 and then click on links, it's there. It's along with the recipes and some of the other things that we have there. It's the couch potato portfolio. It's there. And we do, I think we try every time that Dave's here to update, and I know it has just been recently updated, and that will show you what the asset allocation is, what the breakdown is, and what his recommendations for.
The title of that is, I mean, the last part is called a couch potato, or is it under?
I think it does.
David Sindel's couch potato portfolio.
That's what it's called. It should be real clear what you're looking for and not hard to find.
Okay, great. Thank you very, very much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
We will try and get one more caller in here quickly. Line 4 in Chicago, I believe. Hello.
Thank you. Some people are concerned with the possibility of a bank closure or collapse and the continuing deposit of their Social Security or pension funds into the banks and their accessibility of those funds. Could you comment on that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think most banks are extremely well capitalized. That's number one. And as a result, I don't see these massive bank failures. Number two, are you asking whether your Social Security check may be held up?
Having it available, like if you want to write a check or withdraw?
Well, as long as you have under $100,000 in that particular institution, you won't have any problem. Even if the bank were taken over, it would be seamless by the FDIC and it would be business as usual. So you should have no trouble having access to your money.
One quick question. Some people have contemplated a merger of American dollars and Canadian and Mexican. Do you see anything like that occurring?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, another very quick question. Apparently there are now some Democrats in Congress who are suggesting that there should be – that the federal government should do something further in the way of economic stimulus earlier this year. That basically the two things the government did was declare a number of tax breaks for businesses. And the big thing was they mailed everybody –
they mailed a check.
You a check. Mm-hmm. So now apparently some members of Congress are saying maybe they should do more. The president has said, well – we haven't really finished with this yet. Let's see what happens. I guess my question is, have we actually – can someone say that we have actually seen a benefit, a positive outcome as a result of those checks that got mailed out?
Well, what we have seen is an uptick, interestingly enough, in consumer spending. We
so
did
people
see,
did actually go out and spend the money?
We did see in June an uptick in consumer spending, but interestingly enough, not the kind of uptick that you would have expected as a result of those 60 million checks that were mailed out. So what the administration is arguing is, let's give it another month. Let's take a look at it to see if more people are going to spend more of that money. A lot of people, of course, squirreled it away or paid down on debts and didn't buy new consumer durables.
All right. Well, there we will leave it for this time around. Next month, we will do the show again, but Kevin Wasabi will be here.
Mr. Wasabi will be back.
And Dave will be back month after that.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. We do these programs once a month, always on a Friday.